Good afternoon. So last time we talked about Mmap and the idea of mapping files as part of a program's memory. Question?
Yeah. Can you go over the question two on the quiz? The question about how many pages on memory?
We can do that in a bit. So we talked about Mmap. We mentioned that we had like this shared mode where you can modify the original file, and the way that worked is we had cache copies of all our files, potentially, and those are used for reading from files in addition to Mmap, and you can modify that cache copy directly and have it be in your page table so you can access it directly, even though it's also the OS's memory. And we had the option for copy on write, which we learned was useful for like loading programs, that we want to load a program and not modify the file, but we want to like set the initial values of global variables and have it like be a template. And we learned that Linux manages its process memory basically as just a list of regions that are set up with some hypothetical mmap call. And since we were talking about mapping files into processes, we got to this idea of a page cache, that we really think of all our data in memory, both the data in files and the data that programs just allocate space for, as really being at home on disk or an SSD, and memory is just some temporary fast storage for it. It's a cache. And this is a cache where our cache hits happen because we have a page table entry that says it goes to this place in the cache, and our misses are managed by the OS via a page fault handler. And if we're thinking about program memory and all memory in our system as this sort of cache, we need to say, well, if the OS is managing what happens on a miss, how does the OS do replacement? How does it decide what it removes from the cache when it runs out of space? It needs to bring something new in. And we talked about the optimal algorithm, which was Blady's min. And it was great, except we couldn't implement it because it involved predicting the future, which usually we can't do. So we talked about sort of practical approximations, and they were all based on this idea of approximating least recently used. That we had this assumption that programs had this working set, this set of stuff they were actively using, and therefore recently used things were what we wanted to keep, less recently used things are what we wanted to get rid of. And we learned that, well, implementing actual least recently used is probably not viable because it's just too expensive to track every single memory access. But we can do approximations. And to do that, we can maintain this notion of, for each page, was it accessed since some point in time in the past? Either the hardware can help us with that by setting a bit in our page tables, or the OS can mark a page as invalid, and when it gets what looks like a cache miss, it says, oh, I was just keeping track of whether that was being used, and set, yes, it was accessed. And use that sort of technique to detect accesses. And we can also use this sort of technique to detect whether our cache is dirty, meaning that there's something that belongs on disk that will need to be written back to disk eventually, like we modified a file. Okay, so you had a question on the exam for counting, and the quiz for counting the number of accesses. So it was asking how many pages will eventually be written to disk as a result of this. So both of the mappings, so there were two versions of the code, which is why there are two answers marked correct. In the current version, both of the mappings are shared. And that means that when you write to it, it has to eventually go to disk, because the file belongs on disk eventually. Like when we shut down and start back up, nothing in memory is going to be kept around, and we better keep the changes to the file, or that would be bad. So eventually, the modifications have to go to disk that we actually do to the file. and they have to do it for the parts of the file we modify. Now, your complaint might be, well, it looks like we modify 5K of each of the two files. And that's true, but the way to think about it is we modify part of the first page of the file. So the first page is bytes 0 through 4096 of the file. We modify bytes 1024 to 4096 of that for each of the two files. And the second page is bytes 4096 to 8000 and so. And we modify bytes about 4000 to 6000 of that. So we modify the first two pages of the file. And even though we map four pages of the file, we only modify the first two. So that's a total of two pages per file that were modified. So that's four pages in total that are modified. And that's what we need to write back. We don't need to write back the extra stuff because we can tell that those pages were never written to. Now you might say, couldn't we write back less? And maybe conceptually you could figure out a way of doing this, but the problem is that the information you have based on how pages were accessed only tells you somewhere in this page was written. And if you want those writes to happen without involving a page fault every time, you're not going to get more detail than that unless you like check what bytes changed. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Yeah.
For the assignment, can you talk about the dirty bit a little bit more about like when it's valid and when it's not? I was trying to read some of that.
The dirty bit? Okay, so the dirty bit is, so it's, where is my, okay, so the dirty bit here, this is set on write in the PTE. So when you use a PTE to do a write, the dirty bit is set by the processor. Or if we're emulating it, we're going to get a page fault and record that information somewhere. So this is set on write versus the access bit, which is set on read or write. And the idea of the dirty bit is that to use it effectively, you want it to tell you, do I need to write this to disk? So when you write the page to disk, you clear the dirty bit, and if you see it set later, you know, oh, the version I have on disk must be old. There might be some change, I should write it again. Does that answer your question?
I do believe, and copy on write, is that something that would be copied over, is it only for that current?
So the question is, and copy on write, what do we do about the dirty bit? So in our assignment, we never write stuff back to disk, so we don't care. In a real processor, we have to worry about whether any copy was written, and we have to track that information. Because if anything was modified that needs to go back to disk, we need to eventually do it. Now, write it back to disk. Okay. Other questions? That's what's question six? I don't actually.
Time it takes for like process A, B, and C to.
Oh.
Like how long they take.
The whole thing.
Well, actually, part C.
Part C, which was.
It was each of C's computations will take approximately how long?
Oh, so did you see the answer key first of all? Okay, so maybe we should ask this again because the answer key has like half a paragraph on this.
Okay.
Precisely because I know it's a real question. Also, you should check the answer key because it's definitely possible we made mistakes grading exams. Also, yes, I know there were mistakes on the exams I didn't like. So we have an answer key posted. It's on Colab under resources. In a small number of, in some cases, there are answers not on the answer key we accepted. For example, there's a question about user to kernel mode transitions. If you said there were multiple system calls, that should have gotten credit. If it didn't, it's a mistake. And generally, if you wrote comments on the interpretation of something and it looks like we didn't read them, please submit a regrade. That's probably a mistake. Also, a note on the monitor question. So it was pointed out to me after I released the key that the key we graded with was wrong for the monitor question. So I would have gotten that question wrong. Namely, the condition for dealing with pending videos, you need to wait. You need to not start a non-video download if there's a pending video download, and you would take the last slot. But you don't want to wait if you wouldn't take the last slot. And their answer key just said you always wait if there's a if anyone's pending, rather than only if you take the last slot. And I regraded the, so I updated the key, and I went through all the exams and submitted regrades on behalf of everyone who actually answered the question correctly, but didn't take points off from people who we graded as correct, even though it wasn't quite correct. And there were like six people who actually did figure this out, or close to figured it out. That's what we meant. And yes, I know that some of you found exam questions ambiguous. I try hard every time to do better at this, and I agree I need to figure out better and better ways to like get my TAs to actually proof the exam and have a higher, further ahead process to deal with all the weird ways people are going to interpret questions that I don't anticipate and are often reasonable, sometimes not reasonable. Okay. So any other exam questions? Yes. Okay. So I'm going to move on to talking about more replacement policy. So we talked about access bits and so on, and now we want to use them. So I'm going to give you a replacement policy that takes advantage of access bits, probably the simplest one I can think of, which we'll call second chanced. So we'll have a referenced or access bit. I probably should be consistent. This slide uses reference because that's the name the x86 manuals use. But basically, we start our new pages at the top of a list. And if they're referenced while they're on the list, so here, so at the top, we are, this is clear, the referenced / accessed bit. And then we see if they get set from the time we put them on the list to when they get to the bottom of the list. And if they did get referenced, we put them back on the top of the list after resetting the bit. Otherwise, we choose that page as our, what we'll call victim, the one that we're going to send back to disk. And what we know about that page is that it made it all the way through the list without being accessed, so it probably wasn't accessed recently. And this is pretty low overhead because, you know, we in the processor aren't doing very much to track, to like look at access bits, and we're just having it be set the first time it's accessed, so there's no extra overhead beyond setting it that one time. So let's go through. Yeah, so note that this is called second chance because we can think of it as we're going to do a sort of just in order replacement, take the oldest thing, but we're going to give it a second chance if it's been referenced since the last time referenced. We're going to give it a second chance. Yeah?
I missed it. Is reference accessed?
Reference is accessed, yes. Okay. And if it made it all the way through, we're going to say that's a good choice because it probably wasn't accessed recently. So let's look at sort of an example of how this goes. So we have to have a list of all our pages. And on my list, I have the last added and the end of the list. And I've also kept track of whether it's been referenced recently or not. And we're saying initially, you know, we're starting with this list. So we access, so initially we actually started with probably, let's write it out. We started with three not referenced, two not referenced, and one not referenced. This was our initial list. And when we wanted to bring an A, we checked the thing at the bottom of the list and we said, okay, was this referenced since it's been on the list? And we said no, and that's why we used it for A. Then, once we brought it in, we return from our page fault handler, and what's the first thing the program does? It accesses that page we brought in. So it retries the thing that failed. So immediately it's referenced. So even though we put it on the list not referenced, we cleared the bit before we put it on that list at the top again, it's immediately not immediately referenced. So that's why it says one referenced. So then we want to access B. We look at the bottom of the list, page 2. It hasn't been referenced, so we use it. And again, once we put B in it, that's immediately used, so it becomes referenced. Then we access C, and same thing. We put it in 3, it's immediately referenced. And now we access D, and we have to do some work. So the first thing we do is we take 1 from the bottom of the list, and we say, can we use this? No, it's been referenced, so we're going to give it a second chance, put it at the top of the list, marked as not referenced. Then we check 2. 2 is at the bottom of our list now. Then we check 3 at the bottom of the list. We say, has it been referenced? Yes, it has. Put it at the top of our list as not referenced. Then we check 1, and we find out, okay, 1, it's been referenced. It's not been referenced now. I'm going to put it in there. So we end up replacing A. So questions? This? Yes.
So does it basically just, when you add it back to the top list, if it's not referenced, it turns into reference, and then otherwise if we evict it, it becomes not referenced again?
So the question is, when we add it back to the top of the list, it becomes referenced if it's not referenced? So the reason it became referenced, there's actually a hidden step here. So what happened is we started with this, then we added 1 back to the top of the list when we stored it. So this was our list, but then we ran this, but then immediately after that, we ran this access here. And that made it be referenced. So it wasn't putting it on the list that referenced it, it was the fact that right after we put it on the list to replace it, we accessed it. Because that's why we wanted to put it load A, right? Because it was going to be used. So what ends up happening is that, you know, is that things need to make at least 1 full trip through the list in order to get evicted. Because the first time we load something, of course we're going to access it. Yeah. Question, is this much better than least recently used? No. However, you can implement this. Least recently used, probably really hard to implement. But as far as miss rate, it's worse. Well, for typical access patterns. Yeah.
So at what point is something evicted? You have to make it through twice as not referenced?
You have to make it through, make it from bottom to from top to bottom as not referenced. So you have to never be referenced once you're on the list. But the first time, when we load something, we put it at the top of the list as not referenced, and presumably we didn't load it just for fun. We loaded it because something was about to reference it. And that's why in this example, it always gets referenced immediately when we load it. Yes?
Why is there a C in the 6th
column? Just to label things more. or because I made a typo in the LaTeX code. So. Okay, so. Yeah, so something to note here is when we access B here, it flips the reference bit. So this is why after we bring in D, we access B, and now, you know, it flipped the reference bit because that page 2 was not referenced, marked as not referenced anymore, because we put, you know, gave it a second chance, and it in its second chance it was still accessed, so we know it's recently used. Yes?
So what's an example where you take advantage of the second chance so it doesn't get replaced?
Why don't we just flip to the next slide? I'll give you a bit of time to think through this. So question is, so we just accessed B, so it's marked as referenced. So it's at least going to get, it took advantage of its second chance, right? It went to the bottom of the list, marked as not referenced, and it was referenced before it made it back to the bottom the second time. So we're probably not taking B. So what are we taking, and what happens to the list afterwards? So, someone have an answer they'd like to share? Yeah. So, question is, why can't we implement use? So, we technically can, but to do that, we need to do something every time memory is accessed. So, the question is, why can't we implement resource and use? So, if we want to do that, we need to change the order of this list every time memory is accessed. And that means, like, we're running, like, tens of instructions to change the order of a list for every instruction that accesses memory. That's just way too expensive. Here, we're only doing work when we actually have a cache miss. So, it's a lot better in that respect. Yeah, so here, for example, the code we'd implement would just be in our page fault handler, and we wouldn't have to do anything really special. Okay. Anyone volunteering an answer? So, I guess, who thinks that D is replaced? B? C? Okay, so we're in agreement. So we probably have this. Right, so this is what I got. So first, we take 2, and this would be what we'd replace, but we say, oh, it's just it's referenced, so that's not what I'm doing. I'm going to move it to the top of the list, clear its reference bit, And now I have 3 at the bottom of my list. I look at that and I say, that's not referenced. I can use it. It already had its second chance. And it didn't make it. So we put A in there, and A immediately gets referenced. Yes?
What would make not reference become reference? Just
question is, what makes not reference become reference? Whenever we access something. So B being accessed turns reference to not reference. So the way this works is either the processor is going to set, so here, B was in page 2, and originally it was not referenced. Now it becomes referenced because we accessed it while it was not referenced. And the way this will be implemented is either the processor is going to have an access bit in our page table, or a reference bit in our page table, which will be set by this, set by the processor if it's not already set. And it would do that when it's like reading something into its page table cache. Or we will temporarily mark the page as invalid and have a page fault where all we do is record the reference bit and then set the page as valid and keep going.
So when is something taken off the list? It looks like it's taken off the list in those intermediate ones, but there it looks like it stays the same for like 2.
The question is, why does it stay this? So the question is, why is the list not changing between here and here?
Yeah, versus like everything before it, it looks like it's rotating every single.
Between here and here, we didn't need to do any work. We're just representing that the reference bits are changing. But here, we're working over this process over figuring out where we put D. And to do that, we need to manipulate the list to figure out what's the right place to put D. And that's showing that work.
And so you're pretty much going through the list until you find that not
referenced. You find a place for, not reference place for D.
So if there isn't a place?
Well, the question is, could there not be a place? And the answer is no, because as you can see here, when everything's referenced, it will eventually go through again and not be referenced. Okay, so how about a second exercise here? So what's replaced in this case? Okay, so I got B from this logic. So questions about this? Yeah.
Can you explain this a little more detail, like what happens? It goes from, like where it does the one reference in the third column, and then it goes to the one not reference.
So the question is, what's happening here is that here, we try to put D in. And the first step is we take the thing at the bottom of the list and say, can I put D in there? The answer is no. But therefore, as I do that, I put it back at the top of the list to give it its second chance. So in this our original diagram, it's this operation. The reference bit was take it from something from the bottom of the list because we want to evict something toward D. And it was referenced, so we just put it back on the top of the list. So it's representing that operation.
And so for those very first 3 operations that happen where it goes from like 2 not referenced to 2 referenced, it gets put on as not referenced.
Yes, it gets put on. So yeah, question is, for the first 3 steps, it's getting put on as not referenced, but it's immediately referenced afterwards. So if I was like showing more detail, There would be a step where it's not referenced and then referenced, but then I'd run out of space in my slide. Yeah.
Just because I was confused about this before, maybe it might be helpful to just like put a little key on the bottom of it. Oh, if there's a star next to it, it means you just added it.
Mm-hmm. Probably, yes. Just, star.
Just
Stars indicates, the star actually indicates set from not reference to reference, which I probably should have a key for. Yes. Other questions? Okay, so that's our second thing. So this is a simple policy that's using this notion of accessed or reference bits, which are tracking whether it's been changed in some point in the past. And that point in the past for this policy is when we put it at the top of the list. Now, second chance, it's okay. It's not a great policy. And the biggest issue is that if you have a big memory, it can be pretty slow because you can scan through this giant list. And when you're considering what to replace, because that list is giant, you're likely going to be considering something not a candidate for replacement for accesses a very long time ago. If you think of like having gigabytes of memory. So we want to do something to make a better policy to like tune the sensitivity to how old the accesses are, and also to hopefully avoid scanning as much, which if we're not looking for accesses from a really long time ago, we should like have to look at less pages to find something to bring in. And okay. So we can do this by having a smaller list we're going to scan for accesses. Rather than waiting, giving everything a chance to be accessed, with second chance, that's conceptually what we're doing, is we're saying you put it at the top of the list and give you a chance to be accessed before you get to the bottom. We can do this with a smaller list. And this is the main policy Linux uses for pages that aren't part of files. So we have what Linux calls an active list and an inactive list of pages. And what we do is we start pages on this active list, and when they get to the bottom of the active list, we put them on the inactive list as kind of a speculation. We're just making a guess that the page we added a while ago is inactive. And that guess could be very, very wrong, because maybe we just had a program that has been running for 10 hours using that page. But that's okay. So when an active page is referenced, while it's still on the list, we move it back to the top of the active list. And if it makes it to the bottom of the inactive list, that's the page we choose for eviction. So this is kind of similar to the second chance policy in what's happening with the inactive list, that you get put on the inactive list, and your time on that list is your second chance to prove you have an access. And if you do, you go right back to the active list. And everything on the active list, we're not going to evict. We're going to assume that's memory we want to keep in memory. So start top of the active list, and we just make this guess that oldest things are inactive. And if our guess is wrong, we correct that by moving it back to the active list. Now, there's a question here, and it's a policy question we have to ask, which is what the size of this inactive list is. Because we want it to be big enough that we're not going to have sort of false negatives, where we're going to say, nope, it's not referenced, and then it gets accessed right away. But we want it to be small enough that we're getting a big benefit. And the big benefit is that we have to detect references, either by scanning the reference bits or getting page faults, and that has a cost, like checking all those bits or page faults. And we want to avoid that cost for being too high. And that's the purpose of having the smaller inactive list. So we need to figure out what should the size of that list be, and that's sort of a compromise, right? If we make it bigger, we're going to like be more sensitive to older accesses and potentially have to scan more pages. If we make it too small, we might not realize that things are going to be used because we're looking over too short a span of time, because they don't have a long enough time on the inactive list for us to detect that, oh yeah, we really need this in memory still. Yeah?
So how often do you check the inactive list?
So the question is, how often do you check the inactive list? So check for once. So if we're checking to evict a page, we'll just do that when we want to bring in a new page. So that will depend on how much new memory we're accessing. If we're checking for things being referenced, we want to do that kind of continuously to move them back to the active list. And I think Linux just does some like periodic scanning of access bits typically. But there's other things like that you could do. You could also always mark pages on the inactive list as invalid and learn immediately when they're referenced. But I don't think Linux chooses to do that, presumably because they think access bits are faster. I don't know. Yeah?
No, that less.
Yeah, but I don't actually know the justification. Yeah.
So the active list, are they always taken from the bottom? And so if you reference something in the active list, does it always make it to the inactive list and then back, or can it move from the active list?
The question is, if I reference things on the active list, does it always make it to the inactive list and then back? My understanding is that that's Linux's policy. And I mean, the justification for it is that they don't want to track exactly when everything on the active list is referenced, to make a decision about, is this referenced because it was referenced a couple of minutes ago or referenced like 10 milliseconds ago?
Do they scan the inactive list, or is it just like popping them off the bottom?
The question is, do they scan the inactive list? Not for choosing what to evict, they look from the bottom. Other questions? We can look at this seek algorithm, as Linux calls it, as sort of a general case of a whole family of what are often known as clock algorithms for approximating least recently used. And the idea in these types of algorithms is you have an ordered list of pages, and you track some sort of information. In this example, I'm like keeping a history of whether things were referenced on that list. And you use that information to do something, to make your decision. And you have choices as to, like, do you think that this pattern, that, you know, this here should be evicted or not? That's a choice, a policy choice you make. But you have, this is how you collect the information about how recently was this used. And the reason this is called a clock algorithm is one way you can think about it is we have, like, sort of a hand of a clock sweeping through memory, checking pages one at a time, recording what happens. And sort of seek is in this family of algorithms where that's the technique we're using, that we're periodically seeing this was it accessed since the last time I checked in order to get this history and make the decisions based on the history. In the Linux's case, they're kind of representing that history in a strange way in that they have these lists to represent them rather than an actual, like, here's what I saw the last few times. But it's the same kind of idea. And there's a whole lot of variations you can use on that. Okay. Questions on this sort of generalization? Okay, so far we've been talking about doing things lazily. We don't do anything whatsoever until memory is full. And this is attractive in a sense because, well, if things fit in memory, I'm not wasting any time worrying about things not fitting in memory. But real OSs aren't satisfied with that, and they're a little more proactive. And there's going to be proactive in both of these ways. They're both going to be proactive about evicting pages and writing back pages. So writing back pages is actually very important to be proactive about. So if you think of, what if my I pull the battery out of my laptop right now, how much data have I lost? And if we're only writing things back to the disk when I run out of memory, the answer could be a lot. Could be days, hours. You know, we could just lose everything if we never ran out of memory. And most people do not consider that acceptable. You don't want it to be the case that when your desktop uses power, because you put 64 gigs of RAM in it, congratulations, you've lost all your data. So what they do instead is they scan proactively for dirty pages and write back. And typically they have some sort of goal. So one example might be you try never to lose more than 90 seconds of data, so you write back everything that's more than 90 seconds old that has been marked as dirty for 90 seconds, even if you don't technically have to. Another example policy might be you say, when you close a file, I'm going to make sure that's written back to disk right away, just to make sure, because I think you want that to happen, even though I'm going to keep the file data in my cache. I'm going to write back the changes right away, just in case. So this is something OSs do. This also has a bit of a performance advantage, which is that when we want to replace one of these pages that we wrote back, if we didn't do this write back proactively, we'd have to wait for it to happen when we wanted to evict the page that was dirty. And because we do it in advance, we don't have to wait. And OSs commonly actually want to wait even less when figuring out what page to evict, because evicting a page is kind of expensive. We have to do a bunch of work to mark the page as invalid everywhere it's referenced, which can mean if we have something that is in the page table of processes, we might have to mark several page table entries as invalid. We have to find them. That's actually a pretty time-consuming process. So what some OSs do is they keep a little list of pre-evicted pages. And the idea of this is that when we have a page fault for something we don't have in, we can just take from this list, and that's where we're putting it. And we just like try to keep a little bit evicted in advance so we don't have to wait when you actually access it to do that and make that page fault be handled a little bit faster. And possibly a lot faster if we're thinking of something like the page we're allocating is just all zeros. Because we don't have to do any of the work of like updating our file cache info and updating page tables and so on. And potentially, we already have written zeros to the pages even. Questions about these proactive strategies?
Yeah. If you're not having a reasonable amount of RAM, would you even run into the non-lazy eviction because you'd still have a lot of pages unallocated?
The question is, if I have a massive amount of RAM, why did I run into non-lazy eviction? So if you have a really massive, no, you wouldn't. But remember, we cache files. So And that's commonly been the things we're evicting, too. So like, let's say like I'm playing giant movie files. The OS is going to keep them cached even though I stopped playing them like 10 hours ago. And that's what we want evicted. And we just want to do that work in advance. OK, other questions? Okay, so I have a question here. So LRU, we talked about LRU as a good approximation of like one of the best policies, but it sometimes does a really bad job. So Can someone tell me about some programs you can imagine where LRU would be a very bad policy? Yeah.
You just say you're working with three pages, you have something that go through ABCD, just go through
yeah.
four different processes.
Okay, so you're saying like scanning patterns, like ABCD, and so on, because we're always accessing the least recently used thing. Anything else? Yeah.
Meltdown, because it specifically tries to clear up the cache.
Okay, so you're saying you can write patterns which specifically try to clear it. Let's talk about things that programs do in that legitimate programs do intentionally. There is another class of patterns beyond this repeated scanning that's bad for LRU that real programs do. Okay. This is the arguably simpler but definitely more subtle one. So this is the first one here, only reading things once. If we load a file into a data structure, caching that file probably doesn't really matter because we loaded it into a new data structure. And that's a very common pattern for programs to do, is like take a big file, like a Word document, for example, and load it into in memory. And when they write out, they're going to rewrite it anyways. But with LRU, you're going to say, oh, you just loaded that file. I'm going to keep that cached for you. Even though that's precisely wrong. Now, for a Word document, that might not be a big deal, but if we think of, like, you know, a movie, you watch a movie once, we're going to say, better keep that in memory. You just watch that 5 minutes. I'm sure you're going to want that. And that's maybe not entirely accurate. And both of these are common access patterns. We have some programs which like scan over files repeatedly from beginning to end, possibly large files, or files where the program like loads the file once and then it's done. And this is a problem for the effectiveness of our cache if we're trying to approximate LRU. That these are two cases where we want to deliberately go away from LRU. And the problem is that if we don't do that, well, we're going to do what people might say is polluting the cache. That large file I'm scanning, that movie file I'm watching, because it's like several gigabytes, it's going to evict everything else, or not a lot of other things that are actually being accessed over and over again. And Linux thought about this problem and has a special policy for pages that are part of files precisely to deal with this scanning or one access pattern. And the basic idea is that they consider the page inactive until it's accessed a second time. And the idea is that we don't want large files you just read to be kept around as active pages on that active list. So here's how that works, and we're going to step through this. So our initial guess is that we bring in a file that the pages will be used once. So we bring in the file pages into the inactive list because we're guessing this is probably not going to stay around for a while. So we assume first that when we read a file, that it's going to be read once. And you remember with the second chance, when we added something new, it was referenced right away. So we're going to ignore the first time the file is referenced. And by the first time, I really mean like the first time in some, you know, where we're checking like every 30 seconds or something like that. So we're going to ignore like the first window of time and wait for it to be accessed in a second window of time. And we're going to periodically scan through this inactive list to count those references. So the first time, we're just going to say, yep, it was referenced once while it was on the active list. And if we scan it a second time and find out it was referenced again, only then are we going to actually move it to the active list. So this policy, yeah, does that. And they do something else to separate things out, which is that for file pages, if it makes it to the bottom of the active list as reference, they have chosen to make sure they avoid using that heuristic anymore. So they say, if I cache something and it's accessed a bunch, that's enough for me to withdraw my assumption I need to see it accessed twice. And it keeps it around if it's already been, if it keeps being referenced while it's on the active list. Presumably in order to separate it out from the pages which are new. So questions on the idea? So the key idea is we special case pages which are new or which we think, you know, haven't been accessed in a while, and we look for them to be accessed twice before we allow them, before we consider them active. Unlike with our policy for normal memory, where we said, if it's accessed, it's active. And this is just to deal with, well, you read files once an awful lot of the time. So Linux does this for file pages, but they don't do this for things like the heap, where they apply that other policy we showed. Questions? Yes, yeah.
How many times, like, how many reference bits do they keep track of? How many scans?
The question is, how many reference bits do they keep track of? So my understanding, yeah, it's a little hard to look this stuff up. My understanding is there's one reference bit in each page, and they have an extra bit to say if it was referenced once. And that's all they track. And they just scan through the inactive list to change those values.
And is the only time you evict a page when you add a page onto the inactive list, or is that something that's constantly?
The question is, the only time you evict a page when you add a page onto the inactive list? Yeah. So you only remove things from the bottom of the inactive list when you need to allocate a page. Other questions? Yes.
So if a page goes from the active list to the inactive list, it only has to be referenced one time for it to go back to the active list?
So if a page goes from the inactive list to the active list?
From the active list to the inactive list.
So my understanding, I'm not entirely sure this is right, is that they treat them the same as new file pages in that case, which is why they have this extra policy that if it's referenced when it's at the bottom of the active list, they put it back on the active list. Yeah, answer your question? Other questions? Okay. So you can see that this is a heuristic policy, so it's a guess, but it's a guess informed by things they've seen programs do. So if you're actually evaluating these page replacement policies, well, what you do is you choose some programs you care about and you see if they work better. Because we know that, like, you don't want to look at, are we doing a good approximation of L or U? You want to look at, what are the access patterns actually? So Linux has overall, the combined policy is that they have this list of inactive pages where it's file pages that haven't been accessed more than once since being on that list, and any pages which haven't been accessed recently. And they make sure that an active list has a certain size by pulling from the active list, either pages which, you know, are non-file pages in general or file pages which haven't been referenced since they were on the active list last, and they just take the bottom of that inactive list. Okay, so that's page replacement. So there's another optimization based on common access patterns that most OSs do, and this is to break another assumption about not being proactive. Another assumption is that we only load something when we have a page fault for it. or maybe because the application starts, that we only load it when we need it. And that's usually a good idea, but we can do better. And here's how we're going to do better. So if we access 4, 5, and 6, the next access is going to be 7. That's an easy guess. It's not guaranteed to be right. Like, I could write programs where that doesn't work, but that's a good guess. And this is something OSs commonly do called read ahead, is that they make this guess. They say, oh, I got a page fault for 4, for 5, and 6. I'll just read 7 and 8 for you. And load that in right away. We don't need to do anything special. So let's say we want to do read ahead. Someone give me some suggestions. So some things we need to do is, what do we look for to detect that we have one of these patterns? And when we detect it, when do we read? How much do we read? And what information do we need to keep around to do all that? Someone give me like answers to any part of this. Like, how do we detect that we have this pattern? What's our procedure going to be? Yeah. Okay, so you're saying for how much to read ahead, you're saying try to match the pace of the program. That seems like a good idea. Any other parts we have to do? Yeah.
Maybe for the pattern, maybe sequential.
So look for sequential, and when are we going to detect this? When are we going to look sequential? What? So your notion might be, well, we're going to get page faults. So there's a little subtlety here, which is that if I get a page fault for 4, 5, and 6, and then I read in 7 and 8, I'm not going to get page faults for them unless I do something. So part of detecting the access pattern is need to check for accesses to things we read ahead. So if I read 4, 5, and 6 to bring in 7 and 8, then I want to read in, if the program keeps going, I want to read in 9 and 10. And I just look at page faults, I'm not going to do that. So I somehow want to detect accesses to these things I'm reading in. So one way we could do that is we read it in, but we don't make the page table entry valid, so we can detect those accesses. And that sort of strategy is one common way that OSs do this. Yeah, but there's this subtlety that to detect the reading pattern while we're reading ahead, we need to make sure that we look for accesses to the things we're reading. The things we write in advance to double check that, is the program still going through this file, or is it not? How about anything on when should I start reading ahead? Yeah. Okay, so you're detecting the reading pattern, just explicit hints. Okay, this is in fact something some OSs do, but this is mostly not what they rely on. Okay. Any answers for when do I start reading? Yeah.
Maybe once you have like a certain amount of page faults like in a row.
Okay. So I guess this is like a two-part question. So one is, when is it enough? Is it enough, and you're saying threshold of pages. Okay. So another thing that's a bit subtle is the way I sort of expressed it, it looked like I was going to say, when 6 is accessed, I bring in 7 and 8. But that's not actually what you want to do, because it's going to take some time to read 7 and 8, and you want to make sure you've read 7 and 8 in before the program tries to access it the first time. So you actually want to be a little ahead of the program. So you want to make some guess as to like how long it's going to take to read versus how fast is the program going through, and make sure you're ahead of the program. So let's talk about what Linux has chosen to do for these heuristics. So one question is how much to read, and you know, a good answer is let's estimate how fast the program is going and try to read that much. So Linux uses a different heuristic because they're concerned about a different problem. And the problem they're concerned about is not just keeping up with the program, but it's they're worried about polluting the cache for other programs. Because when we read ahead things, we are evicting things from the cache. So if we read ahead too much, we're going to make other programs perform poorly. So the heuristic Linux uses is they count the number of cache pages from before where it's reading ahead and try to keep the same amount cached. Where the idea is that because that's based on our least recently used like policy, that's a good estimate of how much memory the program should have. But this is just a guess, and it could be wrong. You know, it could be bad based on how the program is actually accessing things. But their biggest concern is that when memory is low, they don't want read ahead to cause other programs to run slowly because their stuff is being evicted. So then we have the question of when. And when Linux reads ahead of a bunch of pages, they keep track of this window, and they choose a page in the middle of the window, and they mark it as something they want to detect accesses of. So they choose like two sizes based on the number of pages that are cached, and they look for an access this far into what they've read ahead, and when they see that, they read ahead another chunk. And to detect that access, you have to do something to check for accesses. One option is you mark that just that page as invalid, just so you can detect an access to it. And when you detect that access, you move this window ahead, you slide this over, and look for an access later on, keeping checking to make sure the program's still using this data. You don't want to keep reading indefinitely if the program stopped. Okay, so questions about these heuristics? And as I said, these are heuristics, so they're guesses. And they're not necessarily good. They just chose them because presumably they sometimes were good. Okay, so we've talked about replacement. So one thing to talk about is what's the fail case for our virtual memory system? When there's just not enough space, we get not bad performance, we get catastrophic performance. And this is because of that working set idea, that programs have a certain amount of stuff they're using, and that's what they need to like do their computation. If you evict so much that you can't store all the program's working sets, then all the time, they're going to be something to read from disk. And because reading from disk is so slow, you're just going to be reading from disk all the time. And because it's the working set of the programs you're writing, you know, they can't do their computation until that data gets read from disk. And so they're not going to get any work done. So this behavior is known as thrashing, where things are moving back and forth from disk, and everything just runs super slow. The question is that's when there's not enough space in the cache, in the page cache, which is our physical memory. when there's just not enough space for what the programs are actually trying to use. We got this like performance collapse. Like it's not like you're like just, you know, slightly bad. It's because the disk is so slow, it, you know, ends up being like, why is my mouse not moving sort of territory. Yeah.
Do they leave like a little bit of space so it's like they're like, you're gonna stop allocating at some point, so like you never get to that?
The question is, do they leave a little bit of space so you never get to that? Well, the problem is that what are you gonna put in that space? So this is something that's reasonable to do if like you have an important program. And something you might do, but it's not something you can really do in general. Okay. And I have some slides on fair page replacement. I'm not going to go over them except to mention the concept. So we've talked about maximizing performance. That is not the only goal you might have. So another goal might be, for example, I have multiple users, and I want to make sure one of them gets to run even if the other user is thrashing. So there are other type families of replacement policies, kind of like with scheduling. Like we had policies to minimize turnaround time, and we had policies for fairness, and they could do completely different things. And the same thing is true for page replacement. And it's actually a tricky thing with page replacement. What do you do if you want to make sure someone has a certain amount of memory, but still do this page cache thing? So that's our, concludes our talk on page replacement. And so we have this idea that we have this page cache, which is all of our program memory and files. Their home is on disk. We use physical memory as a cache for them. And if we're assuming the working set model, we get the best performance by approximating LRU. And we mentioned that there were some things we did beyond that. So one is that we might want to have cases which we know aren't like LRU that we want to handle, like scanning. And maybe there's more I didn't talk about where you might look at, these are the programs I'm running, there's something more clever I can do because I know how my programs behave. It's not like this LRU model tells us. We also mentioned that there's a whole bunch of things you can do about being proactive. So like we work through page replacement policies as you do something at the last moment, and that's often fine, but we can do a little better by taking advantage of sort of idle time to do something before the program needs it, before the user needs it. Okay, so questions on our page cache before I spend 5 minutes talking about introducing our next topic. Yeah?
Is thrashing mainly avoided today by just having more memory?
This question, is thrashing mainly avoided by just having more memory? Yes. And mainly, I say, because you may have experienced thrashing. So if like you've seen a computer where your like browser leaks memory and keeps using more and more memory, and then your machine gets really, really slow, some people may have experienced that sort of thing. That's thrashing. So typically when we see it today, it's usually that something is leaking memory, not actually using the memory. Okay, so you may remember we talked about kernel buffering, that we had part of the operating system that had a buffer for data talking to devices. And we're going to talk more about this procedure for managing that buffer and communicating with the devices. So we know we have in our OS something which knows how to talk to the devices, has their own little buffer in order to make sure that they can, you know, they keep the data that's being sent from the device before the program accesses it, or keep the data that the program's trying to send to the device in the between the time when the program asks to send it and when it needs to go to the device. Okay. So we're going to talk about sort of different layers. And the thing which manages those buffers that talk to hardware are known as device drivers. So they're the part of the kernel that knows how to talk to devices. So they have this buffer for, here's the data I'm reading and writing from this device, like a hard drive or something like that. And they also just know how to communicate with the device. And these are used indirectly. So there's some layers on top of it, often a bunch of layers. So like you use system calls, and they go to this internal interface in the kernel that represents files. And usually there are multiple implementations of files for different kinds of files. And some of these will be represented by devices. And in the POSIX design, there are basically sort of two ways files get implemented, both of which eventually go on top of device drivers. So we have regular files, like files on disk. And these are, uses the page cache, where we have a component known as a file system that decides where they're located on the device. And that component talks to our device driver to actually deal with, like, communicating with the disk. We also have files where you access some device directly. And these are through what we'll call device files. And I'll give some examples of those in a second. And the idea is that both of these ultimately go down to this device driver, which is going to handle buffering data, waking things up, and so on, and the actual details of the communication with the device. First, let's talk about what are these device files. So in POSIX, they've made the idea that when you talk to devices, you're going to use open, read, write, and close. They could have had a different API because, well, that isn't actually a natural fit for some devices. Like, does that, you know, is that the right interface for writing things, showing things on the screen? Maybe not. But your options are open, read, write, close. Maybe you'll also have mmap. But things you do with files work for devices too. And the device driver decides what open, read, write, mmap, and so on do for their device file. So the device file is something the device driver implements the way it thinks makes sense for its device. And we have lots of types of devices, like a device to represent the audio playback on, say, my desktop, devices to represent the hard drive. So if I went to read a particular part of the hard drive, not like a file there, just this byte of the hard drive, I want to read it, that's the file I use to do that. Devices to represent the mouse and keyboard, or to represent my graphics hardware. And all of these are going to provide an interface where we like open it, and we can say, write audio data, and that plays audio. Or I can open it and write data, and that gets written to the disk. Or I can open it and read and figure out the mouse movements. And the device driver is going to decide, along with knowing how the hardware works, what the format of that's going to be, how do we represent audio data, and also it's going to decide how to let you configure that device. So, for example, for the audio device, we might want to set what's the format of my audio data. And you might say open, read, and write aren't really enough, and POSIX agrees with you. So there's an extra system call for configuring devices called IOCTL, which is basically the device driver wanted an operation that wasn't open, read, write, or close. Here it is. So next time, we'll talk about what are device drivers actually doing when they implement this file interface? How do they, you know, what do they actually do when I open, read, and write them? And, you know, send data to my audio card or write data to my disk.